today I would like to talk about conspiracy theories. And I would like to talk about the kind of people who believe in conspiracy theories. And one thing that I need to make clear is that we have to distinguish between the kind of mentally unstable people who believe in massive worldwide conspiracy theories of a fiendish network of insidious evil people who in some nebulous way control the world, and the intelligent and perceptive people who notice that there really are genuine conspiracies of a small number of people, highly intelligent, highly motivated, who are able to change, or at least speed up, the course of world events. One of these was true of myself. World War II, you may argue, would have happened eventually. But, you see, there was a group called the Focus, who was a combination of various interest groups, and they wanted it to happen. And the thing is, you see, I didn't have any bloody money. I was out of government office. I had a small salary as a member of parliament. I had my enormous house Chartwell to maintain. I was an alcoholic. I was a glutton. I lived well beyond my means. I needed their money. So they gave me their money. And I used all of my noted oratorical skill to prosecute the case for war. And eventually, war was achieved. And then once I was Prime Minister, I stopped any attempt by those wicked Nazis to negotiate peace. This is the kind of conspiracy that is very real. And it is what I want to talk about today. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, as I hope you gathered from Winnie there, what I want to talk about today is the issue of conspiracy theories, of who believes in conspiracy theories, and how sometimes they are right. Now, I get a lot of flack on this channel for not being sufficiently willing to accept that there are conspiracies. A lot of people, a lot of my viewers, they are firmly of the belief that there are the sort of giant conspiracies going on that are controlling events, and if only those conspiracies could be stopped, then everything would be okay. And I've argued that that's not the case. I've argued that we live in a cycle of civilization, and in various other videos, based on the intelligence, based on genetic health and Darwinian selection pressures and so on, and we are simply going through that cycle of civilization, and there's really not a lot we can do about it. But there are certain things we can do about it. We can speed it up, or we can slow it down a little bit, based on how we behave and based on what kind of people attain positions of power. And in this sense, conspiracies to attain power and control people, as long as they are small scale, are very, very real. But often they're done in the open. The idea that there is a secret conspiracy of people, and that people with a certain gnosis understand that conspiracy and want to do something about it, that normally is not the case. What's normally going on is there is a conspiracy in the sense of, a group of people organising and planning things in their own interests, and they're doing so practically in the open. And that is and therefore they are controlling events. And that is the difference. And that is what is very real. And that's what I want to draw the distinction between today. But first of all, then, the kind of people that believe in outlandish conspiracies. Now, there's a number of papers on this, and there's been a very interesting meta-analysis called by Goris and Martin Verosak, and they look at 74 effect sizes in 13 different studies on the relationship between psychology and believing in conspiracy theories. Now, what they interestingly find is that although you have lots of individual studies that say there's there's this effect and there's that effect. When you actually meta-analyse it and bring them all together, the effect sizes are very small. The key issues appear to be paranoia and a perceived sense of powerlessness. Now, how they define a conspiracy theory is a vast, insidious, preternaturally evil group of people, a network that is worldwide in scope and secret, that gets together and is fiendish in character and tries to control world events. Now, if you look at the nature, and they also note that it's important that for it to be classed as a conspiracy theory, it has to involve assumptions. It has to involve the assumption of a conspiracy where there is a more probable alternative explanation. So what we're talking about then is very, very outlandish conspiracies, aliens controlling your mind level conspiracies, very extreme conspiracies. Now, who, according to the various studies that they find, are attracted to these? First of all, it is people with what's called high openness, unusual thought patterns, according to various studies. If you are high in openness, then you'll be attracted to unusual things, and one of those may be a conspiracy. Secondly, it is simply those that suffer from paranoia. If you are a highly paranoid person, which is an element of this neuroticism, feeling negative feelings strongly, then you may feel that there is a conspiracy going on against you and against the world itself. The third is people being high in schizotypu. Schizotypu is a scale that ranges from normal to out-and-out schizophrenic. What those people do is they over-detect agency. That is one of the elements of being on the schizotypu scale. You over-detect agency behind events. And therefore, you are prone to believing in conspiracy theories. Another is narcissism. One of the components of narcissism is that you believe that you are special and brilliant, and that you only deserve to be around other special, brilliant people. Now, if you, as a narcissist, do not achieve the high level of social status and esteem that you believe you are worthy of, then what that doesn't make any sense. That's kind of cognitive dissonance. So one way of coping with that is to believe that there is a giant conspiracy against you to keep you down, and that's why you haven't achieved the high level of status that you, as a brilliant, fantastic person, are worthy of achieving. Another of these, again related, is having high self-esteem. If you have high self-esteem and you think you're brilliant and you haven't achieved very much in life, then a way of coping with that, of making sense of that, of your situation, is that there's some sort of giant conspiracy against you because you're so wonderful and important and you need to be kept down. Another one is simply attitudes towards authority. This is a component of various psychological traits. If you have a defiant attitude towards authority, and this might make you paranoid as well and believe in conspiracy theories. And another is simply a low level of analytical thinking, which is a component, not the essence of, intelligence. Analytical thinking, that you can reason in an analytical fashion. And if you can do that, then you will, of course, follow Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is the best. And you won't need to add in conspiracies to make sense of your world when these are not necessary. But if you are of lower analytical ability, then you will do that. Perhaps an element of intelligence as well is that it's low IQ is associated with black and white thinking, and the conspiracy theory tends to involve good and evil in a clear kind of way. Oh, there's the good and I'm part of the good, and there's the evil, and oh, they're so evil and they shall one day be punished because they are traitors, that kind of view. So these are the key issues. Really what you have then is elements of schizophrenia or schizotypu and elements of neuroticism, rather than the traits itself, simply elements of these. Now, the first thing to emphasise before some twit says in the comments section, oh, you're saying everyone that believes in conspiracy theories has low IQ. Oh, you're saying everyone that believes in conspiracy theories is schizophrenic. Oh, you're saying everyone believes in conspiracy theories is neurotic. Before you write that, listen, the effect sizes are small. So the largest effect size of any of these studies was 0.26, one being an absolute effect. The effect size, for example, for analytic thinking was 0.21. Many of these effect sizes were trivial, around the area of 0.1. So we're talking small effect sizes. It's real. If you take a large group of people that believe in conspiracy theories, they will be higher in paranoia, higher in schizotypu, lower in analytic thinking, higher in openness than another random group of people. But it is a small effect size. That's the first thing to understand. The second thing
which was when all of this was sort of put together in a meta-analysis, then a lot of these effect sizes started to fall apart because of the way that it's analysed is different instruments. There's all kinds of problems. So when you're comparing like with like, it starts to fall apart, and a lot of these papers don't seem to work. And what the meta-analysis concluded was that the key predictors of believing in a in outlandish conspiracy theories, I'm not talking about genuine conspiracy theories where it really is a conspiracy, outlandish conspiracy theories, is that you're feeling that you are not in control of your life, a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of being disconnected from the world, being high in paranoia, and being high in schizotypal. And also a syndrome that they call anomia, which is a combination of being a dominant personality type combined with feeling a sense of powerlessness, with strongly needing a sense of closure about things that happen in your life, and with being very low in trust. And what they found, interestingly, is that those things coalesce together into one personality type, which is known as anomia. So that's who believes in conspiracy. That's the psychology of conspiracy theorists. But I should emphasize that we are talking about small effect sizes. And so if anybody says in the chat, oh, you're saying all conspiracy theorists are stupid, you're saying all conspiracy theorists are schizophrenic, then, well, they're just evidencing the fact that they're stupid. But that's the data, right? Small effect sizes. Now, you have to distinguish between that and the real conspiracies, the things which are when you, a small number of highly intelligent, highly motivated, often quite malevolent people get into positions of power. And we know that this happens because what predicts doing well in the world of politics or in the world of finance is high intelligence combined with basically psychopathic traits. High intelligence combined with being relatively low in agreeableness and relatively low in conscientiousness, and sometimes high in neuroticism, because neuroticism makes you Machiavellian, it makes you want to attain power, it makes you want to control the world, you see the world as an unstable, dangerous place, and you want to control it. So this kind of social, psychological type will tend to attain positions of power. And once they do that, then you get the effect which academic agent has talked about in his new book, The Populist Delusion. You get the effect whereby people, you get the organised minority, the oligarchy, who will get together and try and control things in their own interests. Now, you can describe that as a conspiracy theory if you like, but I would say it's not really a conspiracy because often they do so quite openly. They're not really doing so behind the scenes. Or if they are, they're not doing so behind the scenes particularly successfully because it tends to come out. They simply are an oligarchy that has power. The second, and this raises the first problem with the concept of a conspiracy theory, that we apply the term conspiracy theory to any group of people getting together with selfish intent to push the world in their own interests. We shouldn't do that because it's a conspiracy is supposed to be secret. And this raises the second problem with the concept of conspiracy theory, which is that, as happens with a lot of terms that begin in academia, it has become an insult. In the same way that if you're going to call people racist, well, that's no longer a neutral term. That's a term that's highly emotionally laden. Nobody would want publicly, but few people anyway, to admit to being a racist. So that's no longer a neutral term of academic discourse. Far right, similarly, is damaging to be called far right. So in political science, it's not a neutral term of academic discourse. It's a bludgeon word which attempts to encompass people that in any way deviate from the accepted norms, and so kind of reprove them through emotionally manipulating them into getting back in line for fear of an association with the genuine, you know, far right thing. It's rather like the word papist in the past or the word heretic. It's an extremely emotive, extremely damaging word, the aim of which is to manipulate people who even slightly deviate from the norm, who can't possibly realistically, by any realistic definition, be called heretics or papists or whatever, and to sort of bring them back in line. And that's true of far right, and it's true of racist, and it's true of conspiracy theorists, increasingly. Because something that we're not allowed to talk about on YouTube is said to be a conspiracy theory. And yet when those that think it's a good thing assert it, then it's not a conspiracy theory, it's just a fact. But when those that don't think it's a good thing assert it, it's a conspiracy theory, and therefore it's this sort of wild thing. But one could argue if something is happening, evidently, like clearly happening, then and that you have people saying it's happening and that it's a good thing, that's not a conspiracy theory, is it? So it's just a way of shutting down debate about something that's actually occurring. That's the problem with the term. And that was what we saw, what we see, I think, with World War II. It's so awful for us to realise that it's not actually the case that we don't have power and there's this giant preternatural satanic conspiracy that's controlling things and there's not a lot we can do about it. That's not the case. Actually, we could get power if we had the intelligence and the ability to do so, and then we could operate with other people like us in our own interests. It's just that we don't. And that's the problem, and that's the thing that's kind of upsetting. But those conspiracies, if you want to call them that, are very real. And an example of that was with the way in which World War II was manipulated. The British people did not want to go into World War II, but certain people within the elite, such as this group, The Focus, they wanted to go into World War II, and they manipulated, they financially, they funded Churchill, who had no money, basically, and was just Machiavellian and wanted power and money, to prosecute the case for World War II. We got into World War II. Churchill managed to become Prime Minister, and then, of course, he had many, many opportunities to end World War II, and he didn't, because he was a warmonger. So that is an that's the kind of example of the conspiracy that's real. Something that's, if you want to call it a conspiracy, maybe we should just call it a scheme, which is because it's openly done, which is a relatively small number of highly elite people who push things in their own interests at a small scale and do so openly. This is the point, that it can't be a secret. And they may well then dismiss those who say this is happening, those who say, look what you're doing. You're doing this terrible thing, which is going to be bad for us. Oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist. You're schizophrenic. You're something wrong with you. Now, an example of this can also be found in a book by Carol Quigley called Tragedy and Hope. And in this book, he basically looks it's between 1880 and 1963, but basically it's the events after World War One. Now, this was a highly eminent historian, Ivy League trained and whatever, but his book was mainly ignored and sort of not talked about. Why? Because he dared to highlight something which some would call a conspiracy, but let's just call it a scheme, which was a scheme by highly intelligent Machiavellian people to take control of what was going on in the world and push it in their own interests. Basically, it was finance capital. I was a group of people called the Round Table. Now, let's be clear, this isn't a conspiracy. They published a journal in which they were quite clear what they were doing. It was an oligarchy, a group of people of high intelligence and of a certain personality type who got together and decided this is how we are going to try over time to push the foreign policy of America and of Britain. And they were successful in so doing. It was based around Cecil Rhodes. Basically, it was to control UK foreign policy. He sets up a society, a group of people, foreign relations, and eventually they start to control these people with these ideas, start to control newspapers like The Times and The Observer. They have the Rhodes Scholarship, which inculcates people with their ideas. And the idea basically is to use British foreign policy as a means of civilising and thus controlling certain opponents of British power, such as the Boers, such as the Irish, such as the Indians, and so on. These people are therefore were behind the partition of Ireland, they were behind the partition of India, they were behind what happened in Palestine, they were behind what happened in South Africa. And the idea was to make these countries sort of submissive, useful really, in British terms, to stop them from fighting and causing problems so that it didn't interfere with the power of the British Empire and therefore didn't interfere with their financial interests. This was planned out, it was quite clear, it was a scheme, and they were open about it in the journal which they published. Now, after the war, after World War One, they move on to American foreign policy. And this is people not only just Rhodes, because he dies, but Rothschild, Viscount Esher, Earl Grey, the Astors, various people. They're all interconnected. They all know each other. And they move on to American foreign policy, and they push to control American foreign policy. And they're particularly influential up until between about 1910 and 1920. Now, it strikes me that we don't like hearing about this, and this is why this information was not, the book was not widely reviewed, the book was kind of suppressed, and it's equally, we don't like hearing about what Churchill did and his behaviour, because it forces us to accept that we could behave in certain ways and achieve certain aims, but we don't, and we have to sit back and let certain people do so. So it shows us in a weird way that we are not inherently powerless, because that's what these wide-ranging conspiracy theories imply. They're almost like devils controlling the world in a neo-Gnostic way, and we just become powerless, but we feel a sense of power because we know in a deep way that the conspiracy is happening and other people don't understand it. No. This implies that we're not powerless. We have the potential to do things, it's just that we don't. And other people who are smarter than us, who are better organised than us, who have a different personality type from us, those people are able to get together and push things the way that they want and that we don't. And that's not very pleasant. And so we'd rather kind of almost not hear about that. And as for Churchill, again, it's a similar thing. It implies that there was no inevitability to World War II. There was no inevitability to all of these things that happened. It was some people that decided to get together and push things their way. And there was nothing that could be done about it. And you see this also with New Labour. New Labour can be, it's not a conspiracy because it was quite open. It was a scheme. We are going to rub the right's nose in diversity. A deliberate, as one of their members, Andrew Nether, said, a deliberate scheme to change England so that it was more controllable, basically, from their perspective, and so they could basically make more money and have more power. A deliberate scheme. Now that is not, if the evidence is there, and the thing is that normally these people are perfectly open about what they're doing if you know where to look. They're perfectly open. Tony Blair has done speeches where he's perfectly open that what you have to do is don't tell the British people what you're going to do, that you're going to have whatever policies they don't like. No. Just subtly do it, salami slicing, and then you will get what you want. And he's open about this. There are videos of him online saying this. It's in the open. And so it's not a conspiracy, because conspiracies will tend to leak and conspiracies will make people look dishonest. No, it's in the open. What was going on with Churchill was in the open. And those things are very real. So it's the secret large-scale conspiracy that is unlikely, because it will leak and people will be shown up. And that we have the data on the personality of those that believe in that. But the small scale, call it a conspiracy if you like, but it's not even a conspiracy. The small scale construction of oligarchies in order to push things the oligarchy's way against the wishes of the vast majority of the people, that is very real. And it is based on the organisation, which is underpinned by the intelligence and personality of the oligarchy members. So it is not true. If you're going to call that a conspiracy, that's perfectly logical and reasonable. It's the outlandish conspiracies that are associated with certain psychological traits, which people might see as negative. It's the small-scale one, believing in those, I mean. It's the small-scale ones that's just associated with looking at the evidence and being logical and reasonable. Well, I hope that has been of interest, and if it has, then please subscribe. It really helps if you do that. Please remember, I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, and I will see you soon. And goodbye!